that you can build a life, a profession around something that is also simultaneously your creative power.
I just have all these like really beautiful, special, intimate memories of being with my friends and skateboarding. That was like a time when I really felt really happy, I think. One of the first times I felt really like autonomous and really happy and really sort of more in control of my life and my body. All these constraints around how men can express their emotions physically. You know, skating's really just, it's like a dance, a form of dance.
Welcome to the Ruth Stonehouse podcast. I'm Bianca Stone, and I'm joined today by Executive Director of the Ruth Stonehouse and my husband, Ben Pease. And we're talking today with the poet, Matt L. Rohr, who is also a practicing psychotherapist. So we have been talking to a lot of therapists on the podcast and having a lot of overlap in that area. And so it was a perfect opportunity to talk to someone who does both very actively. So Matt, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm very excited to be here with you guys. It's good to see your faces.
Likewise.
So good to see your face.
Did you have Samson on before?
Have we had Sam on?
Well, the reason I ask is,
yeah, there's some important backstory that we need to address. Can we talk about what Ben's wearing?
Yeah, I'm wearing my Fieldhouse Chelsea Piers basketball jersey from a number of years ago when Matt and I were on a basketball team together.
It was a team of poets.
It was a group of poets?
Yes. It was a team of poets, and we played at Chelsea Piers, and most of our opponents were like
bankers,
and their teams were all funded by their banks, you know, and their team names were like the Bank Shots or like
whatever. Chase Manhattan.
Yeah.
Oh, so God.
So we were a crusty team of like poets, and we were pretty bad at first, but like we got pretty good. I think we won a playoff game eventually. Yeah. And we had a winning record a few years in, but the first few games it was like, who let these people play basketball?
And you guys would play at like the AWP conference and stuff, right, too?
We did that, yeah. We did that a couple times, and we went to Northampton and played against some writers from Northampton.
Oh, that classic game, yeah, against like Luke. I mean, Luke.
Luke Bloomfield.
Yeah. He really wanted to beat us really bad.
I know, but they brought in this dude. They brought in a ringer who like wasn't even a poet, and he was the best player. I feel that I'm not saying that we deserved to win, but I think we deserve a rematch.
Oh, definitely.
You know,
rematch in the works. Well, the key difference too is we had five people. They had six.
They had subs. Yeah.
And we're all out of shape. So like,
yeah,
well, maybe Matt's not, but they're...
I remember Ben would just be like dying.
Well, it's also, yeah.
Ben would be good. Like, Ben's got a good touch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, I was curious, Matt, your kind of educational journey from, and maybe eventually how that works into your poetry. Because when we played together, you were teaching.
Yeah. You want me to talk about like my teaching career,
teaching, and then how that led you to
what I'm doing now.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I should start off by saying that I'm from a family of therapists. My parents are both therapists, and my brother is a social worker. And so I think that I always like kind of I always wanted to be a therapist, but I also didn't want to just do the things my parents, I think a part of me resisted it.
You resisted it for different. A long time.
Yeah, and I did a pretty good job of resisting. And I became a teacher in San Francisco. I was working as a nanny. I was working for a nanny with a kid who had some pretty serious issues, but also had a lot of privilege. And then I was also teaching in the juvenile hall system and in the like a probation school in San Francisco, which is a job I got through a friend who was a teacher there. I started subbing and then worked full time. But basically I got to work with a bunch of kids. I was working with like a really wealthy kid and some really some kids who didn't have the same financial privileges as that kid. And, and I just kind of got to see, you know, the, like the difference. They're like, I don't know. I got to see just like different types of kids who needed different kinds of support and the sort of access to support that, that kids with a lot of resources had. You know, they had me to come after school every day to pick them up and hang out with them. I don't know. I just really loved teaching. I felt like I really connected with the kids I was working with. And then I moved to New York City and did the New York City Teaching Fellows Program and taught in progressive high schools. I taught at Lyons Community School in Williamsburg for many years. And then I've taught at Harvest Collegiate High School for like the last 5 years, I think. But I always felt like I was a teacher who was really passionate about like building relationships with kids and meeting kids where they were at. And I often felt like, okay, what this particular kid needs is not to learn like, you know,
math.
Yeah. They don't need to know how to solve for X, right? I mean, they do need to know that too. Yeah. But what they need more than being able to solve for, like, what's most immediate for them is some kind of emotional need or some kind of ability to regulate their emotions or, you know, some kind of relationship, trusting relationship with an adult. I was always drawn to like that aspect of teaching. Mm-hmm. And so I eventually went to CUNY Hunter to pursue my MSW and became a therapist that way. And started doing doing therapy in the schools. So I earned most of my clinical hours like doing therapy in the school where I taught. So I was teaching full time and then doing therapy during my prep periods with kids at the school. So
damn, when
yeah. So it's been a busy couple of years, but I really loved doing therapeutic work, and I love being. It's just. Like, I really love teaching too. I'm not someone who's like left teaching to do therapy because I like was super burnt out or hated teaching. I just, I was burnt out trying to do therapy and teach at the same time.
Yeah.
I just loved working with kids one-on-one. It's like, obviously you can, talk about a lot of things that you can't talk about when you're one teacher with 25 kids. I really enjoyed working with, I had like a group of adolescent boys I worked with for 4 years. So I worked them all the way through from freshman year through graduation and to like kind of help them to kind of be a part of their growing up into young men was really special. And I don't know. I've really loved that work with adolescents and I've more recently started to work with adults as well.
Was that a really hard shift to move from children and adolescents to adults or?
No, I don't think so. I feel like in a way, adults are easier. Like a lot of the kids I would work with were like mandated counseling in the school. And they, you know, there was a whole period of the work of like, who the heck is this guy? I don't want to work with you. What's this about? You know, like a real, like probably healthy mistrust of authority.
You were the punishment.
Yeah. but I didn't mind that too much. And I feel like most of the time we're able to work through that and then do meaningful work. But yeah, so adults, when they come to therapy, they might be resistant in certain ways, but at least like for the most part, they're there because they want to be there, you know?
Right. And
yeah,
probably the groundwork of like understanding child development and like child psychology is so helpful in working with adults.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I think so.
And all the while, too, you're still involved in your poetry, right?
Yeah, I've been writing a lot the last couple of years. I've been writing more like nonfiction work recently, but I have a poetry book. I'm like really a book of poems that I'm really excited about. That's should be coming out sometime in the near future from Spork Press. That's called My War.
Spork's great.
Yeah. So that's, I'm really excited about that. But yeah, lately I've been working more on like some nonfiction writing that's kind of related to like skateboarding and nostalgia.
Well, yeah. Reading the excerpts from I assume the book that's coming out is My War.
Yeah, yeah.
The poetry.
Yeah.
Which relies heavily on aspects of nonfiction, I mean, in a narrative way, and skateboarding too.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about this. This is a book length poem.
I think of it as like kind of like a hybrid novel, I guess. Uh-huh. But it's about, adolescent. It's about male intimacy, I think. It's mm-hmm. about friendship and intimacy, and it's about the sort of intense relationships and connections you have with your peers growing up, doing some type of like creative physical expression, like in my case skateboarding. But I just think of like you know, those are like some of the most excuse me, some of the most I just have all these like really beautiful, special, intimate memories of being with my friends and skateboarding. And that was like a time when I really felt really happy, I think. One of the first times I felt really like autonomous and really happy and really sort of more in control of my life and my body. And so, yeah, it's just like a really special time. And those memories like kind of flicker back to me often in weird moments. But I think like I'm going to read from Joe Brainard's I Remember, which is a poem that I just love. Because I think there's a way that the different sort of memories are like activated that isn't always that, it's not always that easy to articulate why.
Yeah.
And I think that's what I love, like that poem does. Like you can kind of start to see the leaps and the connections between these different memories. And I feel like that's something I try to explore in my poetry. And I also think it's really relevant to psychotherapy, you know, trying to kind of get behind. You can kind of get behind the curtain by seeing what sort of memories are like associated with each other or what kind of memories get triggered in different moments.
Right. Right. It's interesting. It's interesting that skateboarding is such a big part of yours, and this sort of physicality. Yeah. Also, you mentioned in your psychotherapy bio
mm-hmm.
That you love skateboarding and you love surfing, and I don't know if you mentioned basketball, but we know you love basketball.
Yeah.
Therapies and writing is so like wrapped up in like words and memory, and it's not actually mm-hmm. doesn't, but how do you see the physical playing into the psychological? That's like a huge question, but
yeah. I think that there's a way that I think, especially as men, like I know I'm going to speak about stereotype, like in stereotypes, but I think that there's a way that like men are kind of raised to, or especially maybe more in like me and Ben's generation as kids, that like men weren't necessarily raised with like a lot of options for creative expression that were like, mm-hmm. that are considered like masculine. And so I think you see people like getting really into things like skateboarding or surfing or breakdancing, or like there's a few kind of lanes for you to express yourself physically and creatively as a man that weren't viewed as, you know, that where you could kind of have your masculinity intact. And obviously that's like super fucked up that like being a dancer, I just remember there being like a boy on the cheerleading team at my school and like the way people made fun of him. Or like, you know, there was kids who break danced, but like that was like kind of considered acceptable, but other forms of dancing, like people would call those kids homophobic slurs or whatever for expressing themselves in that way. So like, there was kind of like there's like a real constraint on how, at least there was, I think it's changing more. But there's like all these constraints around how men can express their emotions physically. And so skating was like, you know, skating's really just, it's like a dance, a form of dance and a form of like performance art. And it's also a sport. But it's like one of the only ways that I, one of the only things that I had access to where I could try to express something creatively with my body.
How old were you when you started? Or really good?
Was in like sixth grade when I got really into it. Yeah. Yeah.
Sixth grade.
So, yeah. I don't know if that answers your question. Like, you're asking about the sort of psychology of physical movement, but.
Well, I don't think it doesn't answer it.
Yeah.
Doesn't not answer it.
And you continued like throughout, like through college.
I like skated on and off. I like hurt myself pretty badly a couple times and then did mm-hmm. other things and like got into surfing, which is a lot easier on my body. But it's also like one of the only places, skateboarding and surfing, even now in my life, are like one of the few times when I have space to be by myself and be with my thoughts. And, you know, I can go surf and I can just paddle out and like paddle out by myself in the winter and there's no one around and I can just sit there and like emote in whatever way I please. And there's no one that I have to worry about upsetting or, you know, like there, I don't have, especially coming off of teaching and doing therapy, like a lot of my time I'm with another person. So like to be able to have space I think people need space in their lives to just be with themselves. And mm-hmm. it's like obviously really hard nowadays with having a cell phone next to you that connects you to everyone at all times. So like those, when I skate and I surf, I'm kind of like away and I'm with my thoughts and my feelings. And I think that's like really important. It's been really important for me to get to know myself and get more comfortable with my own parts, my own feelings. So that's like another part of it. Like just forget about the skating and the surfing, but just the alone time. and being kind of present in my body. You can't not be present when you do those things. Or you'll fall or like, you know. Yeah.
No, I joke about the alone time. I even said it. There's this trans drummer poem called The Lone that I like.
And yeah.
Like one of the last lines in the poem is like, I must have 10 minutes in the morning and at night.
Yeah.
Without a program.
Without a program. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, it's no wonder that that's when the poetry comes to us, like when we're in the shower or something, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've started recording the way I compose poems now is when I drive to work, I record them as nice. I'm going.
Cause it's that's like your little time. Window. It's yeah.
Like 25 minutes of like nothing right. else.
Right. Well, yeah. I read a lot on the train on my way to oh, work. I read on the train in my phone or. Yeah, that's like
that was a hard transition, to be honest. Uh-huh. Like I was like, oh, my commute's the same time, but like,
but you don't get to read when you're driving.
Yeah, you right. have to be driving. You know, yeah.
I know. I used to read all of the New Yorker beginning to end. Now I'm
like, yeah.
Wow, you did that.
Well, because I would be stuck on the train with only this one New Yorker, and I'd be like, all right, I guess I'm reading all the like talk man. Of the town that I never, you know, usually read.
You go to Brooklyn to like the Upper West Side yeah. or whatever. It's like...
Yeah. My relationship to the New Yorker is just one of guilt because my parents bought me a subscription and I almost never read it. And I just feel bad. It's just like the pile grows and grows and I just feel more bad. But
I feel guilty. I buy it for myself and I feel guilty because I don't.
Yeah.
I can imagine yeah. adding the layer of it being.
Oh, yeah. It's a gift for my mom that makes it tough. Yeah.
It's also just sort of obligatory if you're in New York. You don't really have to read it. You just have to order.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Matt, I was wondering, was the My War being written while you were in school?
I started writing it like while I started teaching. Mm-hmm. And I think like being around teenagers all the time, like really just stirred up. It just like reminded me of, it brought up a lot of my own teenage experience. And mm-hmm. so I wrote it while I was teaching, and I think I finished it before I finished at least like a draft of it before I started pursuing my MSW. Yeah.
Do you want to read maybe just the first section here? That's I don't know. That I'm looking at the one on Boet Press.
Oh, cool. You want me to read this?
Yeah, just because we were just talking about all this stuff, I think it would be good to hear the poem too. And then we can read some of Joe Brainard's, I remember.
Cool. So there's like four sections here. What do you want me to read?
Do the one with Dinosaur Jr. in it.
Dinosaur Jr. Okay.
You can do whatever order you want to do them in, but do that one too.
Aw, that one's sad.
I think you should read that I've got too many windows open first, and then.
Okay, I'll read that one, and then I'll read the Dinosaur Jr. one. Yeah. Okay, from My War. I've got too many windows open. I'm sorry for parking my car so far from home. I'm sorry I lied. A guy at the park asked me to play skate. He was wearing running shoes and had methy eyes. Do you even have a skateboard? He said, I'll come back and play you for money. Then he smoked a cigarette next to the water fountain and started dancing the way metalheads dance. Black bricks, waxy curb. A hawk swoops down and plucks a rat from the grass. Everyone runs away screaming. The first time I skated to school, these kids in the Safeway parking lot asked if they could see my board. Then they rolled away with it. I would have cried if I was allowed. A girl with a red ponytail and holy Nirvana shirt made them give it back. I swallowed my spit. Marissa said, girls are so good. She says men are terrible. She says there's a problem with the way we raise them. I thought skating would be like Thrasher, punk freedom and gliding down handrails. They don't show you how your graphics disappear. Baby with the machine gun, six broken wrists. Chris's ankle after he ripped all the tendons from the bone and quit skating rails. The summer air in the subway is metallic like the desert yard. These two girls who hopped freights with me and Ted didn't wear shoes for 3 years. They ran on the ballast rock when we caught out. One stepped on some rebar and gashed her leathery feet. The summer air in the subway is like her mouth in the drainage ditch, throwing rocks into the water. I'm sorry if I'm distracting you while you ruin the rest of my entire life. Bleeding into the yellow dust, dried mud cracking. Our train got stuck in a siding near Portland, and the girls left in the night to hitchhike north. They'll be fine, Ted said. They're tougher than us. The red curb behind the Mormon church with the pack of guys who always hung out in the parking lot of Accelerate, boneless off the curb cut. The guy who'd stolen my skateboard 5 years ago banged his tail in approval. Chris and I built a kicker ramp in the cul-de-sac. I went to the woods, and when I came home, he could fly. Your battery is almost dead. It's blinking red. I don't like listening to Dinosaur Jr. because it sounds like Ted singing. I remember his yellow Dinosaur Jr. t-shirt and his particular body odor. How vocalists in the 90s tried to sound Southern. The time Ted bought me ramen. Facebook is bad for death. It's like, I'm sorry your friend is dead. I wish Ted was still here. I wish my other friends were dead instead. I wish I was born in the 60s when you could just surf at Malibu and never listen to anyone. Sharks are attacking the internet cables in the ocean. The apocalypse is coming, but for now we have birds. The picture downloading one pixel at a time. The bugs that kill my plants are too small to move. They turn to dust when you touch them. The preacher said Ted's with us in our hearts, and I literally LOL'd. My high school was the first high school in America to have the internet. Al Gore came and cut a ribbon. Our teacher taught us how to find websites for our favorite magazines. Just type in www.thenameofyourfavoritemagazine.com. It worked for Thrasher, but for Slap, it went to a porn site. My teacher said, what kind of magazines do you read? The Rancid song I thought was written for me and Chris is on Gilmore Girls. The drummer for Crimpshrine runs a bookstore chain in Brooklyn. Green Day isn't allowed to play Gilman anymore, but Pinhead Gunpowder is. I wish I'd gotten the Op Ivy tattoo. I really do.
Yeah.
My inbox is the pure sadness. It's snowing. My friend is dead. Walking outside so I can feel more real life. I drop my phone, then catch it. Buy myself the best lunch $7 can buy. I kind of want to read one more. Is that okay?
Yeah, please do.
I hate the cops so much. They choose to be the oppressor. I hate my teachers. They never listen when you talk. They never even learn your name. They act like they care. Then they give you grades. In English, Mrs. Smith cried when she told us her husband died. Then Chris's grandma died and she hugged him and laughed. Oh, sweetie. Dry erase marker on her khakis. Spitting ice cubes up on the black lab table during the dissection video in science. Go outside and be alone, Chris, Matt. Isn't that what you want? To be alone together? Sitting on the cold aluminum bench in the walkway, Chris asked Kelly for a hug. We used to talk about her legs and freckles and the little gap in her front teeth, how perfect she was. She was like, no thank you, softball mitt suspended from her book bag. The ginkgo tree on the lawn is a fossil. Chris says it smells like pussy in the fall. Dinosaurs eat the fruit and shit their seeds along the Cretaceous earth. This Hispanic cop with pockmarks and a golden badge said he was sorry when he gave us a ticket for skating the banks outside the courthouse. He said they built this place like a skate park, but it's illegal to skate here anyways. Makes no goddamn sense. White hydrant, gravel and motor oil in the tree pits. The streets flow slow, black rivers. You don't know which direction. All I feel is you, growing hot and tall in the summer. The light was reflecting off the windows of the courthouse, our sweaty faces in the cops' clip-on glasses.
Hmm. Oh, it's so engaging. I just love it so much.
What's funny, Matt, was when Bianca sent the link, I don't read things in order. So I read the one you just read first.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, I thought it was a persona, or I thought it was like you had different voices, which I realize are both sort of true in their own way, where it's a memory of yourself, you know, it's the young self.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I noticed too that the form may be similar to I Remember in a way, is that our cat is...
Oh, hi, kitty.
Saying hello.
Hello.
There's kind of a function of like each stanza being its own memory. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they will jump connected, but in others, it seems like the first one that you read especially was kind of moving around maybe a little more.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, I mean, I can see why you would want to talk about Joe Brainard's I Remember. I mean, I can see how writing this, I bet once you start actually writing memories down, other things occur to you
and
braid together. And it's like there's something so different about having a memory and then and acknowledging the memory and like writing it down and even, of course, editing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like when I was writing this book, like a lot of, I don't know, there's just a way that I'm just thinking of like the poems I just wrote. I haven't really like stepped back and thought about them this way very much, but I think there's a way that the memories kind of stack up. Like I'm thinking of my friend Ted and just feeling like just that was like a little later in my, you know, I was like an adult and just having these memories with him riding freight trains and just feeling like more free than I'd ever felt and feeling so happy and yeah, like those are like some, it's the same feeling that I think I got when I was a kid skating. And just like, yeah, being like really connected, to your friend and like feeling really like loved and free. And, I think there's a way that like a lot of these parts in this, a lot of these memories in the book that are about friendship just kind of like stack on top of each other and kind of move from adulthood to childhood to adolescence.
It's so incredible, Matt, that you have this overwhelming creative impulse to like write these poems. And then also you built your career around this very similar scenario of like having these like intimate relationships with young men. It sounds really bad, but
yeah,
you know what I mean?
No, I do.
It's just, it it's such a special thing because it obviously is incredibly authentic. Mm-hmm. And that you can build a life, a profession around something that is also simultaneously your creative power. And of course there's like,
and just important to you.
Very important to you, and is constantly active. You know, it's like you're constantly actively engaging with new people, and then developing these relationships, and then, but also at the same time, it's sort of like keeping alive this very special experience that you've had is growing up, and.
Well, it's like you're honoring a thing that you care deeply about by sharing it with the community, or sharing it with others.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I also think it's a way to, like, you know, I know this is like cliche. I remember I had a class with Dodie Bellamy many years ago, and she, I don't even remember what, it was like a really, it's like one of those simple, true things that it's almost cliche, but it's like so true. It's so true. She just said, like, you know, writing is a way to take something bad and turn it into something good. And I think all of us who are writers, like, there's most of us, maybe we don't want to admit it, but I think that, like, you know, it's a way to process trauma and work through hard stuff. Yeah, and just kind of get a new understanding of things. And so I think a lot of my friends who I grew up skating with, there's just hard stuff happened in our friendships and in their lives, and was hard stuff was going on in our homes, or in our, you know, during those times. And then some of these friends aren't around anymore. So I think a lot of just like writing about the past for me is trying to kind of understand, trying to grapple with and understand my own past and trauma. So yeah, there's clearly like a connection to therapy and therapeutic work.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that it's like a complicated, it's like there's so much tension in between the fact that it was such a special and freeing time, as you talked about the skateboarding and being with your friends, but it was almost made more special because of the traumas that were happening at the same time and the turmoils were happening at the same time.
Yeah.
In this way to sort of deal with it, or in a way not deal with it. And then now it's like, now you're dealing with it again on this whole other level by just remembering it, writing it down, giving it a voice. Sharing it with people to respond back to you about it.
Right.
Yeah, well, I feel part of even why the Dinosaur Jr. one caught my eye is like, I think when Fama was here, he played Satan. So when we were, I wanted to play that song on the Google, and then it just kept playing songs, and I played some Dinosaur Jr. And I was like, oh damn, I feel like a poem like this like activates that for the reader as well. And it could be, I mean, that one is one for me that has a connection, but even the particulars almost don't matter, where you, once you see that it's a speaker remembering these things, you're brought back to your own. And I feel like that's part of the poem in a way, is like we're experiencing your memories and the connections between them, and then we're kind of triggering our own alongside it.
Yeah.
Let's read some of the read some of your favorite parts of the Brainerd.
There's also like some stuff in this book I definitely do not want to read on the podcast.
Oh, I know. I was like, well, not everything aged well, but
yeah.
But it did make me think, like, in the act of of this remembering. Like, it's not, he's not,
he shows his messiness a little. He's like, he's not,
I mean, what we remember is not, you know, it's not a PC is the wrong word. It's like, it reminds me so much of therapy because so much of therapy is like accepting like unacceptable thoughts and
and urges, like, and
there's lots of unacceptable thoughts in here.
Yes, yeah, like, which I think is like super brave, you know.
Yeah,
like, but okay, I'm gonna read. Okay, I remember trying to visualize what my insides looked like. I remember people who like to look you straight in the eye for a long time as though you have some sort of mutual understanding about something. I remember almost sending away for bodybuilding courses many times. I remember bright orange light coming into rooms in the late afternoon horizontally. I remember the $64,000 question scandal. I remember the woman who was always opening refrigerators. I remember light blue morning glories on the fence in the morning. Morning glories always surprise me. I never really expect them to be there. I remember miniature loaves of real bread the Bond Bread Company gave you when you went on a tour of their plant. I remember hearing stories about bodies being chopped up and disposed of in garbage disposals. I remember hearing stories about razor blades being hidden in apples at Halloween and pins and needles in popcorn balls. I remember stories about what goes on in restaurant kitchens, like spitting in the soup and jerking off in the salad. I remember a story about a couple who owned a diner. The husband murdered his wife and ground her up in the hamburger meat. Then one day a man was eating a hamburger at the diner and he came across a piece of her fingernail. That's how the husband got caught. I remember that Lana Turner was discovered sipping a soda in a drugstore. I remember that Rock Hudson was a truck driver. I remember that Betty Grable didn't smoke or drink or go to Hollywood parties. I remember a ringworm epidemic and being scared to death that I would get it. If you got it, they shaved off your hair and put green stuff all over your scalp. I remember drinking fountains that start out real low, and when you put your face down, they spurt way up into your nose. A couple more. I remember my grade school librarian, Miss Peabody. At the beginning of each class, we had to all say in unison, "Good morning, Miss Peabody." Only instead we said, "Good morning, Miss Peabody." I guess she decided to ignore this because she never said anything about it. She was very tall and very thin, and there was always a ribbon or scarf tied around her head from which bubbled lots of silver gray curls. I remember in gym class during baseball season, certain ways of avoiding having to go to the bat. I remember on free day in gym class, usually picking stilts. I remember your shirt tails on fire and then you yank it out and say, "Now it's out." I remember your front door is open, or maybe it was barn door or both. I remember bathroom stationery. I remember being embarrassed to buy toilet paper at the corner store unless there were several other things to buy too. I remember a joke about Tom, Dick, and Harry that ended up Tom's dick is Harry. I remember sick jokes. I remember Marianne jokes. I remember, "Mommy, mommy, I don't like my little brother." "Shut up, Marianne, and eat what I tell you to." That's a Marianne joke. I remember having to take a pee sample to the doctor and how yellow and warm it was in the jar.
I'll stop there. God, it's so like, I love it. They're so good.
Yeah, it's really hard to stop reading.
It is.
Well, no, I like hearing for like the little things that tell you what kind of time he lived in.
Yeah.
Like the ringworm scare and like the
whatever
the green stuff is.
Imagine if our biggest worry right now was a ringworm scare.
Yeah.
I would trade COVID for ringworm. Totally. I like all the bodily gross stuff, like the pee. I don't know, like, I think everyone can probably relate to like holding their pee in a jar and taking it to the doctor and like how warm. It's like kind of a pleasant, gross thing. Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's some weird, like you're on the fence between childhood and something more mature.
Right.
Because you're like, you're realizing a little bit. He's not saying it, but like, "Oh, right, my like body's being inspected."
Yeah. But you have the like privilege of holding your own pee.
Yeah. Well, the connection
to responsibility.
Mrs. Peabody.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Mrs. Peabody. It's also super gory, like all this stuff about bodies being chopped up and like...
Yeah.
The diner hamburger. it's pretty, you're right, like Bianca, what you said, like about unacceptable, like it's pretty dark.
Yeah, it's like it goes to show like what we remember, you know, it's very.
But that's also like when you're, I'm picturing him being like 8 or 9, like these memories are from like a kind of time period. And that's like the stuff that like,
that you remember. Like
currency.
You're yeah.
Like, that has you heard of, you know, this? Well, I heard of beef. And they're like, oh, right. You know.
Right. It's yeah.
Like one-upping the grossness.
I remember. And there's my a lot about sexuality too. I mean, it's like.
Right.
And women and men.
Right.
Well, we're winding down in the end here. Right. And it's so fun. It's been so fun to talk to you, man.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I'm so excited
really
about
me too.
I'm excited about everything you're doing. I'm excited about how many of my poet friends are becoming therapists too.
Yeah, there are a lot of us, huh?
Yeah.
There's a couple.
There's a couple, and people.
Not like that many.
Well, people who have been right enough for. I mean, I guess there's just like a lot of therapists in the world.
But no, it makes sense. It like makes sense that writers would become therapists.
Because it does, right?
Yeah, because it's like there's. It's about both are about like intuition and trying to kind of, reframe narratives and. Mm-hmm. There's just so much like overlap, and I think the way of like. The way you think as a writer, especially as a poet, is like so relevant to doing therapy. So, and to being in therapy. So yeah, I get it. I get why there's a bunch of us.
It makes me happy.
Yeah.
Gives me hope, for both therapy and poetry, and just how what it means about the trajectory of this, the people, and of course with everything that's been happening in our world in the past 3 years, it's not surprising that, you know, a lot of people, that therapy is being talked about more, and maybe it just feels that way for me, but
no, I think you're totally right. I think that it's more, I think therapy's become much more socially acceptable, just in the last decade. And I think, the need for it has obviously like really exploded during COVID, because we've all been so isolated and alienated. And, I do think there's a lot. I mean, when I was a kid, I went to therapy when I was in high school, and my friends are like, what's wrong with you? Like, why don't you just talk to us, bro? Yeah. I was like, you guys fucking make fun of me for everything I do. Like literally everything I do, you make fun of me, and I'm supposed to like talk to you about my deepest, darkest feelings and fears. Like, no way. Come on.
Right. This is one more.
Yeah. Like that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, my friends were nice, but yeah, they weren't therapists. Yeah. So I just, now, maybe it's the school where I work, but a lot of these where I was working most recently, but a lot of the kids were like really open. You know, they'd be like, I might talk to a kid about, oh, I noticed like, you know, you're kind of like taking out your anger a little bit on your teacher there. And they're like, oh yeah, my therapist tells me I do that. Like, it's something I'm working on, you know? So they're like, and they're just like open about therapy in a way that like
totally.
Is totally surprising to me. It's like not how I, it was not like that. Back
I don't
in
think
the 90s.
No.
None of my hometown friends maybe were in therapy, and if they were, they didn't tell me.
They kept it secret, yeah.
Yeah.
They were.
I'm thinking back to the therapy experiences that I had as a teenager. It's so shameful to think. It was just so shoddy. It was just so half-assed. And it was very much like medication based, like everything was about like getting people on medication and like,
right.
I feel like that's such a huge conversation that's happening right now on Twitter anyway. It's like cutthroat. It seems to be this movement towards like, okay, well, we all got excited about like antidepressants, like when they came out, and that was like the thing that was happening and
right
for a long time. But now we're seeing that, like, yeah.
Have you read The Body Keeps the Score?
Yeah.
Yeah. I like what he says about sort of like our like Western culture being comfortable with like basically we have this model that we're comfortable with talk therapy and like drinking. Like those are the ways Western culture has traditionally dealt with trauma. Which translates into like talking at the bar and drinking, which translates into talk therapy and like Prozac or whatever.
It's so true. So,
yeah. But there's some, obviously, like so many other, I don't know.
That's not the only way.
Well, it's,
yeah. And they're really limited. It's
not just bitching at the bar, right? I mean, it's,
yeah.
Therapies goes deeper than that.
True. True. Well, especially but I think there's like, I think there's like therapies that are more, I think there are like new models, not necessarily that new, but they're like just models, different therapeutic approaches that are like more like somatic therapy and EMDR, like different therapies that are more like about kind of locating trauma within the body and like making space for it and rather than just like simply, rather than like focusing purely on insight. But all, like,
right.
Which is obviously super important, but anyways.
Right.
Yeah.
And I guess that's kind of what I was getting at before.
Yeah.
But it's like, duh. I mean.
Yeah.
Let's get into the mind-body dichotomy at the end of this conversation.
it just feels like the toolkit is expanding.
Right.
Right. Well, I think we're so disconnected from our bodies that's like getting, even just being like, oh, maybe you have like what are you feeling right now in your body is that alone is like a huge, you know, a lot can come out of that one question.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. I mean.
Yeah, I like participate in a men's group, like kind of collaboratively led men's group therapy. And that I remember the first time I was like asked that and it was, you know, I really hadn't been asked that question, or at least I wasn't open to hearing the question in that way before. And like just being able to like find that my anxiety like feels like a weight in my chest, like being able to name what I feel and notice it was like, I don't know, just hugely like helpful in being able to work through stuff. It was kind of blew my mind. Like, oh, there's a physical feeling that when I say I have anxiety, there's like a physical feeling that goes with it.
I know we think it's all just like up here, and then but it also goes. It speaks to the issue. In I talked to one guy about this. He's really into this, but this aspect of like. He works in emergency medicine, and his like whole campaign is to like get consciousness to be acknowledged as like a physical part of the body. It's like it seems like kind of simple when you say it like that, but it's kind of not. You know, they're sort of like think of as you know, psychosomatic as like this other thing that's like, but just talking about consciousness as part of the body, and the body is. Right. It's much more intricately connected to what happens to our body and vice versa. I mean, it's once you start going in that road, you're like, shit, we're in the dark ages here. You know, like we have so far to go to like understand more the mind body dynamic.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And it's like, and there's like, you know, these practices that have been around since forever that like yoga that are like, you know,
right, of course.
Or like,
yeah, I'm just talking about Western
or whatever. It's true. Yeah. Like we're just like Western medicine is just, I feel like
it's bottom
doctors
line.
Doctors been saying
why.
Forever. We've been saying for doctors always are like, oh, stress, like stress is a factor in health. But like the actually like exploring, I don't know. I feel like I'm rambling, but like just it, like actually kind of like, so then what's next? And like, what practices are there already that like help us to connect more to our bodies and to process trauma or whatever it is through our bodies.
I had a coworker who, you know, he was getting on life insurance. So he had his checkup and he was like, I was actually really hoping they would find something wrong with me.
Oh, of course.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And they're like, because he was almost having like panic attacks or something.
Right, of course.
And they're like, no, it's just the stress.
Yeah.
And that was it. That was the end.
That's the end of the conversation is the problem. Is the doctor says it's stress. And they give you an anti-anxiety medication. They send you on your way. And it's like.
Right. Right.
And then, or I mean, also if they're like, I wanted to talk about this too, but whatever. We'll save it for next time. But like, it's so frustrating how there's so much misunderstanding in the general population about finding a therapist and what that means. And it's like actually so complicated.
Yeah.
And there's so many different kinds of therapists and there's so many bad there, just like with poetry, right? There's so many bad poets out there and like people don't understand like what good poetry is. And that once you do start understanding it, then all of a sudden you see all these good poets everywhere.
Yeah. But
it's, you know, that's why like I went from being like, just so angry at therapy for all it had failed me in the past to being like completely like blown away by the whole world that was existing that I hadn't. It's like this with probably all occupations, but
yeah, that's true. There's so many choices. I mean, I guess it's like, I think that like, you know, like there's like all these different modes of therapy and schools of therapy. And there's also a lot of research that shows that like the quality of the relationship with the therapist is the most important healing factor. Mm-hmm. And that most experienced therapists, even if they're trained in EMDR or they're trained psychodynamically, that once they actually have like a client in front of them, they just pull from their toolbox whatever they think is going to help the client most at that time. That's not to say there aren't like clinicians who work really sort of strictly within a framework, but
it's really about the relationship.
I just want to throw that out there that like looking for someone is kind of like, can be like dating. Like you have to find someone that can meet you where you're at and connect with, even if they're not like, you might think you want to do CBT therapy, but maybe there's someone who is more psychodynamically oriented that you really jive with. I would say go with the person that you like, that you connect with, not with the like mode that you think you want.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because
you don't know what you want.
Yeah.
You can definitely find out what you don't want by going and thinking. But I think it takes so much energy to go to one therapist that it just seems impossible to like shop around. Just because it's like getting in there is so hard sometimes.
It's super brave. Like you have to be so brave to just like to send someone an email and be like, I have problems and I need your help. Like I want to work with someone on myself. It's like a really brave, it's like a really courageous and scary thing to do. So yeah. And I get what you're saying. Doing that like over and over again is tough. Get it.
Which is why it's good. I like that you put the sort of APB out about your new practice and were very explaining what you were doing and saying you were like referrals. And I think actions like that are very helpful. I mean, I know you're new and so that's great.
Yeah. I think if people are like listening to your podcast and they're like, I need to find a therapist, I would say to ask your friends who are in therapy to, if like anyone who knows a therapist that they like, they have a good therapist, to ask them for referrals, because therapists tend to kind of connect with other like-minded clinicians. If you don't have access to that, then like, sure, just like look on Psychology Today or whatever. But if you can get like a name or a name of an organization from someone who you trust, like that's really can really help.
Thank you so much for listening. A reminder that the music today is provided by Walter Stone, and you can read more about the Roostone House at roostonehouse.org. Matt O'Rourke is a licensed psychotherapist and executive functioning coach. You can read about how to work with Matt at brooklyntherapy.org.